Pop quiz, hotshot. What's the difference between charity and philanthropic investment? If you don't know the answer to this question from the Dadages Dictionary, I encourage you to go back to the February 22nd, 2023 episode of Dadages and have a listen. If you already know the answer, stick around and enjoy this companion episode of Chatting with Dads. Friends and family, welcome to Dadages and another episode of Chatting with Dads. The dadage that corresponds to today's episode is, I don't believe in charity. I believe in philanthropic investment. As I said in the cold open, the definitions of these two terms and the distinction between them was the subject of our prior episode of Dadages on this topic that means a lot in my life. What also means a lot to me is fellowship. The ability to connect with like-minded people and talk about topics that are important to me. That's one of the reasons I'm so excited about today's episode of Dadages. Today's guest is Chris Gardner. Chris and I only met a couple of months ago through LinkedIn. When we spoke by phone, it was clear that there's a great deal of common ground between us. In particular, Chris and I have developed very similar perspectives through our lives regarding philanthropy. And we've both taken a very professional approach to our philanthropic engagement. I'm not going to rattle on with a lengthy introduction. I prefer for you to learn more about Chris's life, his work, and his family through the course of today's interview. So with that, Chris, I welcome you to Dadages.
Thanks, my friend. Looking forward to being with you. I've so enjoyed the podcast.
We love you being part of the friends and family. And, you know, I'm just going to start out bluntly and boldly by saying, Chris, why are you here today, man? You know, what motivated you to join the Dadages friends and family and to join us for this episode of Dadages?
Well, we went from a 15-minute phone call that was very enlightening to me. There were other people like me. You know, it's one of those things where you go, oh, so there's other people. I'm not the only one.
Kindred spirits, so to speak.
Yeah. And so, you know, talking about what we do and how we donate the money that we've been entrusted with and what we do. And you said, well, you got to go back and listen to a couple of episodes. And I'm a guy that does as much as I can. So I went through and I started at episode one and I listened to the last episode yesterday and it's in my list now. So we'll be listening to it going forward. You do a great job and I've thoroughly enjoyed the guests you have on it.
Oh, that means so much, Chris. Thank you for the warm compliment. And thank you for being an avid listener, maybe a professional listener at this point, and a member of the Dadages friends and family. We really appreciate that. And, you know, Chris, let's talk first about your day job. What exactly is it you do professionally? And how does it tie into our Dadage today about philanthropic investment?
Yeah, so what I tell people that I do for a living is I'm a philanthropic strategist. There are three basic levels of wealth. For your first job, step number one is to produce more than you consume. And those aren't the people normally that we work with. We may work with some people as they are building and they have that potential, but it's, hey, you got to produce more than you consume. The second step is you've got to produce more than you will consume. You need to have a plan for when you're no longer able to do what you're doing. We call it retirement. Although I never plan on retiring, but we still have to pass the bus test. If something happens to us, how have we prepared our family for so we produce more than we consume, then we produce more than we will consume, and then we produce so that we can reproduce. And that is our, that is when we do our philanthropy. So I am the guy that sits down with people and says, I know you've had a wealth manager in the past that has done and talked about your investment strategy, but honestly, your investments don't even matter anymore. You're set for what you will consume. I'm the guy that sits down and goes, let's have a strategy for making sure that our philanthropic endeavors make sense and that we are as tax efficient as possible and we're able to give as much as we can.
So you're really that advisor for that third phase that you talked about. Once somebody's taken care of their own nest egg and their family, how do you then give back and how do you approach that? As you said, strategically, I think that's the important
word. Correct. Yeah. The strategy matters so much. And we understand that in business. And we have honed a skill to where we produce tons of income. We've done great in producing income, but we want to make sure that after you get to that, I work with level two and level three. So level two, hey, I've got people that are like, hey, I make $5 million a year, but I've never set a dime aside for retirement. And I'm like, okay, I get that you don't plan on retiring, but let's make sure your family's taken care of if something happens to you. So that's a step two. But then the three is where we really hone in. What are you passionate about? Yeah. What matters to you? How can we make sure that we give in the most efficient manner?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's clear that what you provide and the service and the expertise that you offer is not just your average financial advisor. How would you kind of compare and contrast that for those people in the Datagist friends and family that maybe have never had a financial advisor? What could they expect from your, like I said, the average financial advisor versus what services you provide?
Well, so we believe that money as wealth is can be broken up into four quadrants. You have your investments that matter, and every financial advisor is going to talk to you about them. Morgan Stanley did a study that stated that 95% of people who had a financial advisor did not have strategy. So you have investments, you have strategy. Do you have a written out plan for what you plan on doing? And this is a plan that changes every single day because your plan is outdated the minute that it leaves the printer. You change, your goals change. So investment, strategy. The third one that nobody really focuses on and the fourth one are what we are experts in. The third one is family, because the question isn't how much money should I leave for my children? The question is, how much money have I prepared my children to receive? A guy goes, how much is too much? And I'm like, you're asking the wrong question. Have you prepared your family? The third quadrant of true wealth is how to prepare your family for that money, preparing your wife, preparing your children, making sure that everything is all together. And then the third one is legacy. Legacy is built upon the other three strategies working out correctly. So I'm different than a regular financial advisor in that most financial advisors spend 95% of their time on the left side of this quadrant with investments and strategy. Yep. We spend 95 on family and legacy. And we tell people we misunderstand the word legacy because we think that the word legacy is about after we die. And I'm sick and tired of people wanting to leave a legacy. I want you to live a legacy. Do we have time for a story right now just to give you kind of what I mean by that or not?
Please, I love stories. They make things much more clear and understandable.
So I'm sitting down with a guy the other day that has liquid investments over $50 million. So we're just talking. I said, so what are you going to do with your money? What are you thinking? And he's talked to me about how he's given money to start for a college in India. And he's done, like, this man is loves giving. And he said, you know, I've got, it's actually $85 million is what he had in liquid assets. Literally able to bring to the table $85 million. He's an older man, still makes $2 million a year, lives on less than $100,000. Loves his life, very happy. I said, so tell me what your plan is. How much are you going to leave for your kids? Because every person needs to be asked three questions. Number one, how much is enough? No financial advisor likes asking that because the more that we manage, the more we make. But you need to know how much is enough. Okay. The second question is, how much is enough for your family? And the third is, what do you plan on doing with the rest? And why don't we start that now? And so he's sitting there with $85 million. He's an older man, way beyond the age of actually even being mandated to receive Social Security. And he said, well, I'm leaving $2.5 million for each of my children. I have two because I want to give them a leg up in society, but not two legs on the couch.
That's five. I can do that math. That is about 80 million.
And I said, and what are you going to do with the rest? And he goes, well, my financial advisors, they've told me what they want me to do. You know, when I die, all that's going to go to help different nonprofits. Yeah. And I said, my response was, I'm known as being pretty transparent. And I go, interesting. And he goes, can you tell me what you mean by that? And I said, honestly, you probably don't want me to tell you what I think about that. And he goes, no, I really want to know. I said, well, here's what I think. That has to be one of the worst plans I've ever heard of. And he said, what do you mean? I said, you love giving and you're going to wait till you die to do it. Makes no sense. I said, he said, how would you do it? I said, let's take $5 million, set it aside for your kids. And the problem is it's going to grow. And as it grows, we're going to put that back into that box for the philanthropic strategies that you need. And I said, so we're going to take $5 million and we're going to go crazy and say you might need $10 million if the whole world falls apart all around you. So we're going to put 10 to the side. I said, last time I checked, let's see, 85 minus.
Or if inflation goes up any more than it is now.
Exactly. Now that's a true statement. I was like, okay, so 85 minus 15. Let's see. Last time I checked, that is $70 million. I said, we need a plan to where we're giving away $7 to $10 million every single year hoping we can outgive what the market gains for you. And he goes, are you serious? There is so much wealth that could do so much good and advance causes so well, but it's sitting on the sidelines because of the fear that is bred into people by supposed professionals who are worried about their bottom line. And that just scares me.
Yeah, because they want people holding on to all that money so they can manage all that money, so they can charge fees on all that money, rather than seeing it go to a good, productive, valuable use that makes the world a better place. So it sounds like there's a complete misalignment of incentives between these investment managers and the financial advisors and the clients that they're serving.
Yeah, I would say that there that could definitely be said. And I would tell you that we use the word fiduciary, and the word fiduciary is supposed to mean that we're always in your best interest and always take the step that's correct, to the right step to be taken. But I believe that a lot of times the fiduciary duty is seen through the lens of the return to me. I personally believe that we've got to battle that. So the way that I've decided to battle that, I still get paid on assets under management. So you're like, so Chris, why would you recommend people to give money away? And the answer is this: my wife and I started with a finish line in sight. We said, okay, this is how much money we're going to live on. We revisit that number every year, and it can go up. It can change. This is not some Mother Teresa have to live on $10,000 a year thing, but we say, this is what we're going to live on. So if I make any more money than that, guess what happens? I'm able to be a philanthropist.
You're giving it back
So guess what? If I make $150,000 more than what I made before, so I don't feel any pressure to bring on clients. Yeah. I'm like, if I make more, it doesn't matter. All I get to do is impact society more by what I'm doing. So
your clients magnify the impact of their positive impact on society by empowering you to move further into that phase three of life you described, and then you being able to pay forward the additional money that you're making as well. So there's a additive and multiplicative effect along the way.
Absolutely. And they love it because they know, they know I'm just giving through secondary hands now.
Yeah. And let's come back for a moment to the Dadages episode that is the companion to this. And a couple of the things that I talked about in terms of my philosophy and how much it aligns with everything you're saying. And I love everything that you're sharing. I love the perspective. I love the approach. I love the impact you're having on your clients' lives. So a couple of things. I've talked about the difference between charity and philanthropic investment. So in the notion of philanthropic investment, there's an accountability component. And these high net worth individuals who have been very successful on their own, have made all of this money in their own lives, like this client that you just shared with us, presumably these are very smart individuals that are very capable of making money, effectively investing money, and managing those investments as they go out the door. So for them to say, I'm going to take a passive approach and put all this money on the sidelines while I'm alive, one, they're delaying the positive impact they could make. Two, they're delaying their ability or eliminating their ability to see that positive impact for themselves and to feel the soulful positive impact it has on the rest of their lives to see the good work they're doing. And three, they're eliminating the greatest asset, which is their own management skill, which they could apply as time along with their treasure to invest in supporting the causes, supporting the organization, supporting the initiatives that they are funding with their philanthropic investment. They're taking an opportunity to be active players in improving the world and removing themselves from the equation altogether. And that's why I love your philosophy and your approach and what you're talking about. Do you think I'm hitting the nail right on the head in looking at that?
You know, one of the principles that I teach people as we're talking through stuff is that generosity produces more income. It's amazing the way it works. A generous person, when they give, you know, I was listening to one of your latter Dadages episodes when you ran across Jorge.
Yeah.
And you needed a plug-in. You couldn't find a plug-in. And so the only reason he was on here, the only reason he was on the podcast was because generosity touched you and generosity touched him. This is that, but that's what happens when generosity is put into play. It is the great magnifier of you producing wealth, because people that are locked in on money and nothing but money, they end up finding out that it doesn't fulfill. I'm writing a book on that right now. And they lock in on this hey, it doesn't fulfill like I thought it would. But guess what? Generosity, oh, it changes everything.
Yeah.
And once you're generous, then all of a sudden it's like, how the heck did I make two? I didn't mean to make $2 million extra. How in the world did that happen? Yeah. It happens because generosity has a flywheel effect to it that produces more income.
That's amazing. And one thing that unfortunately you don't have the benefit of right now is we recently recorded an interview episode of Dadages that has not yet aired. So as of this moment in time that we're recording this episode, neither the friends and family nor you have heard this episode, but it's with Ken Honda, who wrote the book Happy Money. And it was an amazing interview. And Ken talks about exactly this notion that there is energy associated with money. And when you can do positive things with the money that you have made, you pay that positive energy forward in the universe and help spread happiness. And it's just such an amazing perspective. And I can't wait until the sequence of these episodes is published for our audience. And so by the time everyone is hearing this episode, they will have the opportunity to go back and listen to the Ken Honda episode if they have not done so already. It just fits together so perfectly from a philosophical standpoint.
Yeah. And I love his book, by the way. Yeah. Great book. The typical management of money is it's just flawed.
Yeah.
It's flawed because here's the way that we do it. We sit there and we go, here's a hand grenade. I'm going to hand it off to my family. And when I die, I'm pulling the plug.
Wow.
Guess what? It's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah.
Money has ruined more lives than anything else in this world has. And giving a person that is not prepared for it $100,000 is a mistake. But when you add 3 zeros to that, it is a massive mistake to do that. So we tell people, don't hand off a grenade and pull the plug when you leave. Let's have a plan today. Let's make sure and work that plan now, because now is where you can make an impact. And you're right. You want to see that which you gave money towards. You want to see the results of that. Making that a priority in your life, I believe, is of the utmost importance.
For sure. And in the episode with Ken Honda, one of the things that we talk about is I kind of put myself on the block or in the hot seat and talked with Ken and had him look through his lens at my life. And one of the things that my father has always been afraid of is this notion that in families where wealth is created, the first generation creates the wealth, the second generation sustains the wealth, and the third generation squanders the wealth. And his fascination with this crosses over maybe to the point of obsession. And it has created a framework within my family where I look at that third generation, which is my children, my two boys, and say, gosh, they shouldn't be held accountable for guilt for something they haven't done and hopefully will never do if we do exactly what you're saying, educating and preparing the family to receive the wealth versus just saying, as you said, what's the number I can give them without ruining them?
Yeah. And the truth is, if you give, there's no number too large for someone that's prepared to receive the money. Yeah. We have clients that are incredible, but they put philanthropic boards together with their family, and they have the board is sitting at the table and the junior board of the children outside of the table. And they're listening to their senior board as they're talking about why to give, why not to give, who to give to. And then they offer one child the ability to come in and say, hey, let me present something I would like to give to.
So Chris, you've described your process, your approach, your philosophy in dealing with your clients. And as I said, I love it. It sounds fantastic. But let's back up a bit. Walk me through exactly how you get started with clients. Let's imagine for a moment that you and I have never met before, but I've come to you as an individual who has had some professional success. Transitioning from, as you described, that first stage to the second or third stage in my financial life. I've never engaged in philanthropy before. This is something that's a new world to me. You and I get on a Zoom meeting together. What happens next?
I like talking to people and making sure that they understand that generosity does not happen at step three. Generosity is a mindset. Generosity is while we're building to the producing more than we consume, even at that point, generosity is not some far distant thing. Generosity needs to be a part of who we are. Because what I have found with money is this, Everybody says money changes people. Money doesn't change people. What money does is money allows people to be who they are. I teach people from the very beginning, I think you need to live a life with open hands. And the need that you could fulfill today looks way different than the need you're going to be able to fulfill later on. You're not going to have your name on some marquee or on some college building. Now necessarily, but in that first step, generosity matters. You may be generous with your time because you have extra time. You may be generous with your talent. You may be generous with being able to serve others, but generosity is a mindset. It's not something that kicks in at step three. It's one of the biggest concerns I have with people that speak about generosity is we want to talk about the people giving away $10 million when I believe that a person making $25,000, everyone around him ought to know that they're generous.
Such a remarkable point. And as you said, money can help you sort of unlock who you are. I think great wealth can help you magnify who you are, to be even more of what you are and to make even more of an impact. And I have to say, I'm very much aligned with what you're saying. And as I've shared with the Dadage's friends and family, my own story and my own background, it follows the lines of what you're talking about. I had the blessing of being able to have a degree of financial independence early in my career based upon some early success. And I made the decision I was going to be who I wanted to be. And that generosity is important to me. And I wanted that to be a part of who I was. And I wanted to shift 50% of my capacity away from just working in my business and devote that capacity to being able to make an impact through philanthropic investment. And that's not just my money, but also my time, as you said, and the talent that I have from working in a professional sector. And that talent has grown as well, along with my wealth. I've learned over 15 years of engaging heavily in the philanthropic world, how to navigate that world and how to have a much greater impact at this stage of my life than I could 15 years ago. And it's been very, very rewarding, has really helped me to progress as an individual in addition to making an impact. Now, I know generosity is important to me. Why does generosity matter to you, Chris? And how do you empower generosity in your clients, as you've discussed?
Let me first just rewind a little bit and say something about what you said there. I have been impacted very positively by listening to Dadages and hearing your generous spirit. But people that are not generous from stage one, they believe the checkbook answers the question of generosity. And that's where charity becomes a problem because we think that it's just money that is needed. Here's what I know. If great players were playing a game of basketball and Michael Jordan walked onto the court today, it would raise the level of the game. And so he's old. He's not a young man anymore. He's not, but he would raise the level of the game. His expertise would raise that level. So as you are dealing with your philanthropic ideas and entities, it raises the game because people on, I serve on quite a few nonprofit boards and I help people know how to raise money, and raising the level of the way they look at the money that is given matters. And people like you are key to that happening. People like you are key to that happening, getting on the board and they go, huh, I've never thought of it that way. Well, guess what? Your donors do. And so this is a great way for you to get it.
I've certainly found myself on more than one occasion challenging the development officers within the organizations in which I interface because they're not accustomed to people bringing more than just the checkbook to the table. And in some ways they get, I think, some philanthropic organizations, some nonprofit organizations that depend on philanthropy, let me put it that way, get a little bit complacent and a little lazy in the way that they solicit money. They are just looking for the check and they don't really understand how valuable the rest of it can be. But there's also work involved in engaging and unlocking the rest of it from a donor and from someone who wants to make a philanthropic investment of their time and their capacity as well as their money. That creates more work for the organization than just taking their check.
And I would tell you that the time that you invest is worth more than the money that you send, because the time that you invest prepares the groundwork for other philanthropic people to come in and go, I am also willing to do this now. So you are reproducing yourself at that point. And that's that third level of wealth. You produce more than you consume. You produce more than you will consume. And then you produce to reproduce. And that is what you're doing. You are producing to reproduce. And you're reproducing in nonprofits. You're reproducing in all of those things. So I believe that that 3-minute segment is probably the most helpful one for people that are listening in that have been very successful and find themselves at the third step. is to understand that. And it can change the world when men like Chad decide, I'm not a checkbook. Okay. Yeah. A check is part of it, but that's not who I am. I'm going to bring my expertise to the table and I'm going to put sweat in the game. I want to put, you know, that's a game changer for sure. The world that we serve. So.
Absolutely. Let's come back to this concept of generosity. I want to know more about Chris. I want to know, in terms of what makes you tick and what drives you to do what you do, why does generosity matter so much to you as an individual? And then how are you empowering that in your clients?
I probably have one of the most different stories that you'll ever hear for people that are in the wealth management place. I grew up, I was 11 years old, and my dad came into the house one day and said, I believe God's calling us to be missionaries overseas. Nothing strange happening at 11, you know, nothing happening in my head and my development as a young man, you know, nothing. All of a sudden we're like uprooted from Georgia and we moved to Mexico to learn Spanish. My dad raised money to be able to go there. He had to raise money by smiling and dialing and, you know, shaking hands and kissing babies and asking people to donate for us to go overseas to serve. So I moved to Mexico, was there for a year, and then moved from Mexico to Peru, where I lived over 25 years of my life. The only reason I'm back in the States is because my son was born with a cleft lip and palate. Last week, he had his 23rd surgery. And he's 12 years old. And it's just, it was the right move to come back. And we took a very large ministry in Peru. We started dozens of churches and a Bible college, a TV station, a radio station, an orphanage. You can only imagine. It was a very vast network of.
Yeah, that's a remarkable impact. That's incredible. And you and your family must be very proud of what was achieved.
Yeah, I have an amazing father. I have an amazing mother. My legacy is a legacy that I stand very proudly on and I'm very thankful for.
So, well, that's what I love about your story and how, you know, like many life stories and many members of the Dadage's friends and family who have been on this program, I can draw a pretty clear through line in terms of your upbringing, your parents, your experiences as you're describing them, the influences in your life and what you're now doing, what you've devoted yourself to as a career and in helping others and the way you work with others. Share more. I want to hear more about the family stories, the friends and family, and how you evolved and those influences that had the greatest impact on you along the way.
Yeah. So move back to Georgia. Move back to Georgia. My parents, my dad had moved back. He was working in a church here in America at that point. I moved back. My brother still lives in Peru. I go down all the time. I visit, love Peru. I tell people I look white, middle-class American, but if you peel me, I'm 100% Peruvian on the inside because over half of my life I've spent it in Peru with the Peruvian people. And so.
And I bet your Spanish accent is fantastic.
Yeah. On the phone, nobody knows it in Peru, we would have to go out and I would make deals on the phone before they saw me because they would know that I was an American and I'd make deals on the phone.
And they're like, who is this gringo showing up?
And I'd be like, hey, let's meet at the mall down there by Kentucky Fried Chicken. And literally I'd be sitting there and the guys are on the phone and he's like, you're not here. I'm like, no, I'm talking to you. And he goes, where? He turned around and he'd walk to the table. He's just like, what? So yeah, it's I still dream in Spanish mainly. I lived on the side of generosity. The way I lived in Peru and did the work down there was because of the generosity of others. I would sit down and there would be a lady living on Social Security writing a $10 check to help us do what we were doing in Peru. And then for supper, I'd be sitting down with a guy going to write a $100,000 check that was going to help for building a college building down there. So it was just living and sitting across the table from generous people. It changes you. You cannot be the same when you're around generous people. It changes everything about you. So that puts me in a niche that most people don't understand. Number one, money doesn't scare me. I don't care how many zeros you add to the end of it. It doesn't scare me. I've been around very generous people. And because of that, it was just a natural fit to be around and helping people that are generous.
Well, not only does money not scare you, but asking for money for a good reason doesn't scare you. And I think that's an impediment to so many people. They're really afraid to ask. And what I would encourage people to do is at some point in your life, find a way to start small. Just dip your toe into that pool. For me, the origin, and this just story came back to me this last weekend. I had lunch with my freshman roommate from college. His name is Eric Streisen. And Eric invited me when I was a freshman in college to join him in working for the Stanford Student Calling Program. And this was the program where Stanford students would come in and they would call alumni who had made donations and they would thank them for their donation. And they'd tell them stories about how their money was making an impact on campus and share the narrative of what it's like being an undergraduate at Stanford today, because many of these people were alumni that were many, many years removed from being on campus. And then ultimately, there was a fundraising component where we would engage with people who were either donors to help make them repeat donors, or engage with people who had never donated before and help raise money from new individuals. It was a very safe, structured environment to learn those skills and learn how to engage with people and how to talk about money and how to raise money and how to ask for money for a good cause. And that has paid so many dividends for me throughout my life. And I told Eric, I have him to thank for the entire trajectory I've had from that moment forward. That was one of the key little influences that had a major impact on the unfolding of my life. And I'm sure for you, having your father as an example, and you talked about him going door to door basically and raising those funds for your family to be able to go and start the missionary work, I'm sure that was really influential in breaking down those barriers for you, demystifying the fundraising experience and making it possible for you to carry that on.
Yeah. And you know, I believe many people fear asking because they don't truly believe that the impact is going to do more for the giver than what not giving does. So it's I knew that my parents were going to spend the money well. I knew that they were going, we never lived luxurious lives. We put it to work. We put it to use. But he knew, Chad, you're better off if you give me that than you would be if you went down to the McDonald's and bought a Happy Meal. And of course, that's hyperbolic. But you understand what I'm saying. It's lifestyle creep happens to all of us. And lifestyle creep happens to the extent of, it literally will happen no matter how much money you make.
Yeah, luxuries can very quickly become necessities if you allow them to.
Absolutely. And you know, I have clients of mine that go, hey, I'm selling a business for $25 million and can I make 180 on that a year? And I'm 180 on that. And I say, yeah, absolutely. Not a problem. We'll put it in the market, work for you. And he goes, no, I'm in 180 a month. He needs 180 a month to live. But what has happened is the lifestyle as his, you know, and there's no lifestyle that's right and wrong. You have to decide for yourself the lifestyle. But if you're not careful, you'll never produce more than you consume, no matter how much you make. And then you can't produce more than you will consume. So you'll never be a reproducer of yourself. It's impossible to do it at the point. So.
Well, and I liked two things you said that I want to just go back to so we don't miss the point, because they're important points. One is you talked about the $100,000 ask versus someone who's on Social Security who really wants to make a difference and can make a gift that's very small, but very meaningful. One of the things that I've said in past episode of Datages is that in building nonprofit organizations, there is no such thing as a small contribution. Any contribution is extraordinarily valuable, and you should have great gratitude for anyone that aligns themselves in supporting philanthropy. The second thing that you said is you talked about how much more giving benefits the giver than it does the recipient. And one of the greatest development officers that I have ever had the pleasure of engaging with is actually a member of the Datages Friends and Family and has been a guest on the podcast. If you haven't listened to it, I would encourage our listeners and our viewers in the Friends and Family to go back and watch or listen to the interview with Robert Witt. So Chris, I really love those perspectives, as I said, that you shared. And I really just wanted to underscore those points for the friends and family, because I think they're so important. I'd really like to kind of change our lens now. And rather than looking back and you've shared your origin story and all of the influences that made you the man that you are today and defined the focus and objectives of your life, tell me now about you becoming a dad. As I understand it, you tried to have kids for 8 years. You ended up adopting two children and then had two children after that. It sounds like quite an interesting road to building a family, a blended family. And, you know, like many members of the Dadages friends and family, it seems that your experiences of becoming a father and being a father have had just as much of an influence on your life today as your upbringing that we talked about earlier. Can you help connect all of these dots for us?
We tried to have kids for 8 years, went through the crying yourself to sleep at night. What in the world? What's wrong? Nobody could tell us why. It was very, very difficult times. Just a door opened in a crazy way. We discussed adopting children for the first time on June the 7th, 19 years ago. On June the 7th, we talked about it. That's also my anniversary. Did not know anything about adoption agencies, knew nothing about any of that. Door after door opened, and on July the 26th, we had two children.
Wow, that's amazingly fast. I mean, I've heard stories of the adoption process taking years for some people.
Just a crazy set of circumstances. My wife and I wanted to have a child. We're talking to a crisis pregnancy center that is a friend of a friend's, and she goes, I think I might be able to have two children that you might be able to adopt. And we were like, we didn't want two children. We wanted one. It ended up being the most amazing blessing ever. And so we adopted Jacob and Hannah. Jacob was 19 months old. The mother had passed away, postpartum depression, suicide. You know, just he was 19 months old. And my daughter that was born, she was 7 weeks old. So we adopted them. It would be impossible to love anybody more than I love those two kids. They are just amazing. I do know that I probably would not have adopted if we'd have had children. I'd have been like, no, we had kids. That's okay. And I believe God was like, nope. You just keep trying, get frustrated. I need these two kids that are going to be your children. And so we adopted them. 2 years later, my wife comes in and she says, babe, I think I'm pregnant. I'm like, don't do that. We've done this for 8 years. Don't get your expectations up. Don't get your hopes up. I said, well, go to the doctor. But we both know we've had so much of this in the past. And we went to the doctor. And sure enough, I told her, I said, you're crazy. And, you know, he just was giving back and forth with each other. And she laughed and we went and she goes, she's pregnant. And then a year after that, she said, babe, I think I'm pregnant. And I said, I'm not saying you're crazy because I end up being the crazy one. End up having our fourth child, Joshua, and been married 27 years. I outpunted my coverage so far. It's not even funny. I don't deserve the wife that I have, but I have been blessed by an amazing marriage and great children. And children are probably the number one thing that teaches generosity in my life now. One of the practices we have as a family, because I believe generosity matters so much that even when I didn't have a lot of income, I told my children, I said, we're going to let each child choose somewhere to give $100 a month. And you're going to have to present to the family why you're going to give it there and why that entity matters and how that's going to help and what's going to be the impact of that $100 that we're going to give. But it's taught them to think through, don't just write checks. Don't just send money out. Make sure that you understand. So they think through those things. And so they give their money away and then goes from one child to the other each month and they each get to present. And now they want to put their money with it. You know, they're like, hey, I'll add this much money to that. I like that plan. And hopefully I'm raising some generous kids that are going to impact other people's lives. Success is you building money for yourself and you, but significance is impacting others. And I truly hope that they'll be significant from day one.
Well, it sounds like you're already ensuring that they are significant from day one or from day zero, even before they're out on their own, managing their own wealth and the product of their own hard work. You're teaching them to work from the family's wealth and to distribute the family's wealth and to be active participants in it. I think that's so fantastic that you're able to include them in that process. And by the time they have left the household, giving is going to be a habit for them and probably a habit they'll be unable to break, fortunately, a very good habit. And I love the story that you shared about your challenges and being able to have children of your own initially and then going the route of adoption. I find so many times, and this narrative comes out over and over again, with individuals that we talk to here at Dadages and the friends and family, there's something missing in our lives or something that we missed out on. But so many times over and over again, I hear these stories and the common thread is that thing we think we're missing, the absence of that thing is what's creating the space for something far greater. And it's clear in your case that the space it created is you being able to adopt those two wonderful children. And then you were rewarded for that by being able to have your own two biological children to add to that family after the fact. It's such a beautiful story of following in the footsteps of destiny and arriving at a fantastic destination.
Yeah, I cannot tell you. I feel like the luckiest man in the world. I feel like the most blessed person ever. I wouldn't change the script of my life for anybody. You know, the failures have brought the successes. The successes have brought the failures. And it's just, it's the tapestry that is woven in our lives is incredible.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like you have done a great job. There's this concept of bringing your work home with you. And usually that's a negative concept that, oh, we have the stresses of work and life and we bring those home and walk through the door and unleash all of that frustration and angst on our family. But it sounds like you've brought work home with you in a beautiful way, that you take your life's work and your mission and you share that with your family. I know I am blessed with a unity that exists in my life, the unity of my work and my life coming together to just be one thing, my life. And I think that that is such a beautiful thing. We can make that happen. I imagine you must feel the same way and feel truly blessed that you're able to synthesize the two and bring it together in a meaningful way.
I tell young people when they come to me, I love mentoring. I tell people I manage money for a living. I help 501c3s and I mentor young men for my life. I love doing that. And I tell them, you can build a life that looks like that, because I don't think you need to have a life where you need to take a vacation from it. Now, we need time away. We need time to rest. We need time to recharge, but we got to be very careful that we don't build this life to where, oh, it's now time. And so, yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's a such thing as balance. I think that the balance is a balance-driven life, because you have literally stated, I am going to live a life I enjoy and bring all these facets together, because without them, I'm not happy without the work I do. I'm not happy without the family I have. So why would I separate those and go, I don't love the balance idea. I know the intentions are great, but I think a lot of times it shifts us to a place that can be dangerous to be.
Creates a forced constraint where you're looking at the situation as being oppositional.
Yeah.
Rather than a way of looking at it as being integrated and unifying, as I said. And I think that's fantastic. And all of these different pieces that you're talking about, your good work, your professional pursuits, your professional growth and development as a leader, your family life, all of these things are part of your legacy. And I want to come back to talk about, you said something earlier that I really love. You talked about the difference between leaving a legacy and living a legacy. Can you kind of put a bow on all of this for us and talk about the legacy that you're living and how you would advise others in the Dadages friends and family to be able to walk in the footsteps that you've placed there to live a legacy?
What I would say is that those that are concerned about leaving a legacy rarely do. Those that are consumed with living a legacy always do. If you're consumed with, I've got to live today the legacy that I state. You know, everybody has a different plan for the day they become wealthy, and it never happens. Or the day they become healthy, or the day that they become, you know, so live it today. And if you live it, here's what I can guarantee you. Money back guarantee. I'll give it to your children. Money back guarantee. If you live the legacy today, you will have the legacy you desire tomorrow. But if it's a future event, you're never going to get there, because it's always in the future.
And when you paint something as being a future event and saying, I'm not there yet, you're also saying, I'm not good enough yet. And the reality is, we are all good enough. We can all do good. We can all make a positive impact. And we just have to embrace the fact that we can do it right now. And I think if there's anything to take away from this discussion, that to me is what's most important.
And I would tell you that if you think of the legacy of the people that have impacted you the most, it will always be on the back of generosity. They were generous with their time. They were generous with their money. They were generous with their love. They were generous with their counsel. Whatever it is, they were generous. So if you want to leave a legacy, the backbone of that is generosity. And it may not be a fat check right now, but you're a generous human being no matter where you're at in the stage. Legacy for me, the rubber meets the road the most in the fact that our country is about to, we have begun the largest wealth transfer in the history of mankind. Over the next 25 years, $84.4 trillion will be handed down by people that are passing away that are baby boomers. Now, here's the weird part about that. $72.6 trillion of that money is going to go straight to the heirs with no thought outside of the fact that my kids get it all. It's the greatest wealth transfer ever, and we're stuck on investments and strategy, and we forget the family and the legacy. That's what it gets. So you better make sure the world is about to change. Everybody's like, nobody's going to be able to retire like they did before. Oh, absolutely. Because the greatest wealth transfer ever is going to create that. But if we don't prepare our family for that, we're preparing them for failure. Money only multiplies. Money is going to multiply your sorrow, or money is going to multiply your generosity. Let's prepare them to multiply it well.
Absolutely. Live your legacy, exercise your generosity, and pass down the benefit of your good work to the next generation.
I'm going to use that. I love it.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's just such a great message. It's so empowering and so meaningful. And in terms of getting that message out there, Chris, you mentioned earlier you're writing a book.
Yep.
I think that's amazing. And I understand you're rolling out some other new ways to deliver your wisdom to the world. Can you tell the friends and family about where they can connect with you now and about what the future holds?
By the time this rolls out, we'll have a website that will be titled checkwhatyourechasing.com. That's the title of the book, checkwhatyourechasing.com. Because here's what I believe. I believe that you can chase health, wealth, and self, and you're going to find out that it's like drinking salt water. You'll get all the wealth in the world, but it will not fulfill. One of the greatest things you can do for the wealth, health, and self to fulfill is to let it be carried on the back of generosity. We're just talking about how that generosity is a big part of that. Checkwhatyourechasing.com. Domain is bought, site is built, and we will, that's the name of the book. The book will be coming out. Probably it'll be out the first week of December, but we're probably going to wait till January because everybody's focused on Christmas before that.
Well, that's fantastic. People will come off of the generous season of Christmas giving and be able to find new and wonderful ways to pay it forward and live their legacy by exercising their generosity. I think that's so fantastic. And we'll look forward to keeping tabs on you, sharing with the Dadage's friends and family when the book is available, making sure that we stay in touch and that we have an opportunity to share your good work and your messages with the rest of the friends and family as they come. We talked about living a legacy. I'm going to give you the opportunity to help us continue to live another important legacy, which is the legacy of the bad dad joke. We give each one of the friends and family an opportunity to share their worst, best dad joke when they come on the podcast. I'd love to hear yours, Chris.
Well, the main reason I listen to the podcast, well, it's not the dad jokes. I'd be lying. But I did want to make sure that my dad joke hasn't been told already. So my favorite one has a Hispanic background, as you can imagine, because I'm from Peru, South America. But my favorite dad joke goes like this. What if soy milk is just regular milk that's introducing itself in Spanish?
Oh, boy. That is terrible in two languages. Congratulations. That's a first here on Dadages. I love it. I love it. Te amo. Te amo.
There you go.
I love the dad joke. I love everything you've shared with us. And this has been a great experience. And Chris, thank you so much for being a part of the Dadages friends and family, both as a consumer and now and helping us to produce great content and messages to share with the rest of the friends and family. This was amazing. And thank you again for your time and for being so generous and coming on board with us as well.
Thank you, Chad. Thank you for your work of love in this. It has meant a lot to me, and I really appreciate what you do. My wife was telling my kids about it because she overhears me listening to it and was telling them about the podcast. Thanks for your work of love. Keep up the great work. And I am one of your number one fans. So keep doing what you do.
Likewise, right back at you. And I really appreciate it. And to the rest of the friends and family, remember, Dad may not always know what he's talking about, but he sure can sound like he does.